Spam. What does that word mean to you? An inbox full of junk mail that clutters up your feed? Or a feed of salty tinned pork? Like it or loathe it, for plenty of communities around the world, it has been a kitchen staple. It's a relatively cheap form of protein. The world's spam supply comes from an American company called Hormel. Hormel's spam spread across half the globe in World War II. The countries who consume the most spam are the USA and South Korea. Kelly Spring is a food historian who has written a history of spam. She co-presents a podcast called The Hungry Historians. Kelly joins us from Washington. Hi, Kelly.
Hi there. Nice to meet you.
Yes, you too. Now, we've got to start with demystifying these two types of spam, email or a pork product. They are, in fact, linked, aren't they?
In some sense, yes. So spam, the pork product, came first in 1937. And spam, the email, like junk email, came much later with the, you know, internet and email. And they're linked in the sense that Monty Python did a skit. This is a British post-war like comedy sketch on TV. And the troupe did a skit about spam, the food, and they were in a sort of greasy diner in Bromley in London, and you see sort of a man and a woman sort of come into the diner, and basically the whole menu is about spam, and it's like repetition of spam, and the wife hates spam, and the man loves it, and he wants extra helpings, and strangely, in the corner, you see this sort of group of Vikings who occasionally will break out into kind of a chant or a song of spam, spam, wonderful spam, lovely spam. So that kind of repetition kind of got that going, and so that's where that idea of like repetition and junk connects to sort of our junk mail that we think of today.
Well, we can in fact have a little listen of that Monty Python crew in their cafe.
Excellent. Morning.
Morning.
What you got then?
Well, there's egg and bacon, egg, sausage and bacon, egg and spam, egg, bacon and spam, egg, bacon, sausage and spam, spam, bacon, sausage and spam, spam, egg, spam, spam, bacon and spam, 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 egg and spam, 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 baked beans, spam, spam, spam and spam. Oh, lobster thermidor, crevettes with mayonnaise sauce, garnished with truffle pate brandy and a baguette on top and spam.
Okay, so that was 1970. And Kelly, yes, it's not hard to see how we get from surplus offerings of the food spam to surplus emails. But why did the Hormel company call the canned pork spam in the first place?
I know, this is really interesting. If you look online, you know, there are various people's variations of what they think it is. People think it might be a combination of like spiced ham or specially processed American meat. But actually, there's no answer to this. So Hormel sort of created, when the food came out, before it came out in 1936, they had a competition to name it. And I think it was the brother of their vice president won the competition, and he named it spam. So it was a bit of nepotism from the start. But actually, Hormel never reveals this detail. They're very tight-lipped, and so you can't find the information anywhere. So I tried to find out this detail, and it's not possible. So don't believe the rumors that you read online. It's not. People come up with some really excellent variations, and I invite the audience to try their hand at it. But yeah, there's no answer to that question.
Yeah, well, a couple that I saw were spiced pork and ham and specially processed American meat. I mean, both are worthy, but, you know, that's not the reason, as you say. What about some of the other misconceptions about spam, like the idea that it's ultra-processed?
Yeah, I think this is really interesting. Spam gets a bad rap, you know, not at first, but like after post-war period, I think probably from the 1960s when there's a bit more affluence in American society and elsewhere, spam kind of gets a bad rap that it's sort of full of chemicals and full of like terrible bits of pig that nobody else will want to eat and they can't produce anywhere else. But actually, it's not an ultra-processed food. So ultra-processed foods don't come into, you know, common foods, particularly American food systems, until later in the 20th century. So spam was made well before that. And interestingly, if you look at the ingredients for the original can of spam, there's only six ingredients. And all of them, except for one, which is sodium nitrite, you can buy easily in the grocery store or you can find it in the pantry. So it's very easy, in a sense, to replicate replicate the recipe at home because it's not the sort of ultra processed. So it gets a bad rap for being like terrible and, you know, bad for you. And of course, you know, it's a meat and it's fatty, so you're not going to eat it all the time, but it's not as bad as it's made out to be in the media.
Yeah. So as you say, you know, ultra processing didn't come in until much later, but has the company mm-hmm. essentially stuck with the same format since its beginning?
Essentially. So the original formula is almost the same, except for now they add potato starch. And that's for to help the meat congeal better. So essentially, the meat is kind of ground up and it's added sugar and salt and a little bit of seasoning. It's put in the can after it's ground up, and then it's cooked in the can when it's sealed and cooked in the can. And so originally, when they made it, there'd be a kind of separation when it was cooked. So there'd be a kind of gelatin or fatty bit that would separate out from the meat. And so when you open it, you get this like layer of fat, which is useful for, you know, if you're in wartime, for example, and you need a bit of fat for cooking and you don't have it because you're on rations, but it's not very attractive. So in the post-war period, at some point, they put in potato starch and that helps the meat congeal together. And so that's sort of the only change to the original recipe. However, there are at least 15 kinds of Spam now. So there's 15 kinds of, and they have all different recipes. Some are, for example, turkey Spam. Some are Korean barbecue Spam. And so those have new ingredients that were not original to that first recipe.
And was this idea that they first used, was it a technological innovation for the 1930s?
In a sense, yeah. I mean, during the sort of turn of the 20th century, you get companies like Heinz and Campbell's Soup kind of trying to make canned goods. And so that became a really popular way to so industrialize the food system, both in the United States and elsewhere. And so Hormel really wants to get into that as well. So they started the company in 1891. But at this point, they want to get into like the canned market because that's where all the money is. And so they start to make these different canned products. So its first canned product is a whole canned ham, which you can actually still buy. And they were the first company in the world to actually make that. But then they proceeded to make other canned goods, which were very useful. Many of the canned goods came out in the 1930s when America's in the height of the Great Depression. And these things are inexpensive to feed families who are, you know, underemployed or unemployed and don't have much money. And so in that way, they are revolutionary for their time.
Yeah, and I guess there's a couple of things there. You know, people might have got their meat from the butcher shop. Maybe that became too expensive during the Depression. Yeah. Butcher shops were closing down. I don't know. I'm imagining this, but it was designed for the Depression, and I wonder how much thought there was about having a life beyond that.
I think, you know, because they're business people, they really wanted to have a product that was good for now, but also that they could keep in their line of products and expand on. So originally the product came about because the company essentially had this kind of pork shoulder left from its other processing. So they had pork shoulder, which they couldn't use elsewhere. Pork shoulder is kind of a tough meat. It was sort of low value. And they wanted to do something with this product, otherwise it would go to waste. And of course, that would lower their bottom line, you know, because it was waste. So they decided they could grind it up and add these different ingredients and make this product. So it was part to address the need in the nation, but also part to address their business need. And so that kind of waste would still go on because they've got all these different products. And so they needed to do something with it long term. So I think it wasn't necessarily only for that time period.
And then, of course, along came World War II and the international rollout of Spam, really as an exercise in aid.
Yes, certainly. And I think World War II, many people think World War II was when Spam started. It wasn't, but it was really the making of Spam. And as you said, it's about aid. So America didn't join the war until after the bombing of Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. But at the same time, they're still trying to figure out ways to help through different aid programs, particularly to Britain, as well as the British Empire, the British Commonwealth. And so one of the things that they rolled out in the spring of 1941 as Congress passed it and Roosevelt signed it was the Lend-Lease Act. And so this gave essentially unlimited aid in terms of food, military hardware, medical supplies, to the different allies. And so spam becomes part of that aid, as well as many other food goods from all different American companies. So that's how it starts to travel the world to the allies as aid.
And so who got most of America's spam during that time?
Yeah, this is really interesting. I mean, Britain is essentially alone in the war, fighting the war, as many of the other allies had been occupied by the Nazis, as well as the sort of Japanese that's happening. And so much of the war of the aid goes to Britain, British Empire, and the British Commonwealth. So the bulk of it really goes to them. And so they get all this food and they get all this spam, and then spam becomes part of sort of the everyday experience of, particularly on the British home front, it becomes part of British rationing, which is really important to sustain the British because they had really reduced amounts of meat and protein. And so it was really, really helpful and helped, I think, fill that gap and help them proceed with the war effort.
And is it true that in the UK today you can get spam fritters in the fish and chip shops?
Yes, you can. Yeah, you can still get them. You know, they, it depends on where you go. Sometimes it's popular, sometimes it's not. You can also buy them in the freezer section. If you go to any regular grocery store, such as Sainsbury's, Tesco, you go to the freezer section, you can buy these sort of spam fritters, which are essentially spam, which are breaded, and then you fry them or you maybe bake them at home. They also have cheese spam fritters if you want that in the freezer section. So yeah, it's still there. You can still buy it, but spam is not really that popular in Britain as it, you know, as it was during the war, as it was necessary during the war.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm Tracy Holmes, speaking with Kelly Spring, the author of Spam, A Global History. How did you get so fascinated by this product?
So, you know, I was introduced to it as a child. We used to go camping and my parents thought they would try, you know, try out Spam. So just like frying it over an open campfire and eating it. But I didn't like it at that point. So that's really remarkable. Like, I didn't want anything to do with it. But my focus, my PhD, my research in food history is related to World War II, and particularly the British home front. And so when I was doing my PhD, I could see mentions of spam, but I didn't really have time to cover it. I also lived in Korea before, and so I could see it in Korea. And then during the pandemic is really when I had this chunk of time to like sit at home and to entertain myself, I would just look at like British Library, old newspapers from World War II and look for spam. And so it was sort of like I stumbled into it by accident, I guess, or I had a lot of time on my hands. That's what, you know, historians do when they have time on their hands, they do more research. So that's how I got into it.
So Kelly, your kind of reasoning there for having delved into this product, it sounds a little bit like the Monty Python sketch itself, like spam, 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 spam. It just keeps reinserting itself into your life and all of these different moments within it. But you mentioned Korea there. So spam has gone from World War II and dominating the UK, and it marches into Asia and the Pacific. Tell us about that period.
So in World War II, you know, spam basically went everywhere the American soldiers went. So if you sort of trace where they were in World War II, you can see that there's probably some remnant or some explosion of spam in that area at that point and onwards. And so as the Americans are in the Pacific theater, you know, they're moving towards the Japanese home islands as they're doing so. They're liberating different islands. So, for example, they occupy Guam, you know, the Philippines, and so on. And so as they're sort of coming ashore, they're realizing that people are starving in these areas and they need to be fed something that is easy to, you know, easy to provide to them. I mean, spam, because it's already cooked in the can, you don't actually need to cook it if you don't have cooking facilities. So, you know, if you're in a decimated war area and you don't have cooking facilities, you can still eat it. So it's a great source of protein in a conflict and war zone. And so the servicemen would give these to these sort of starving populations that they would find. And spam would make the difference between food insecurity or starving and, like, you know, living and surviving. And so that was really important. And so today, when you go to places like the Philippines or Guam, there's huge amount of popularity of spam, and you can find it in everybody's sort of pantry, as it were.
What about Hawaii? Because that enters the picture as a big consumer. And I guess what we're seeing here is also populations that really have pork as quite an essential ingredient in their cuisine.
Yes, indeed. So Hawaii is a really great example. I mean, if you look at the consumption of spam throughout the United States, Hawaii is the top consumer. And this, again, has to do with the war. So Hawaii was already a sort of naval base at the time. But after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, it really expanded. And there's huge military construction and huge number of men and women coming in to join the war effort. And so because of that, you've got this huge influence of spam coming in with the service members that's being fed to them in the mess hall and so on. And so this becomes sort of attached and to the Hawaiian population as well. So they're exposed to that, you know, it's being flown in. And it's in some ways the Americans have to take over a lot of the Hawaiian traditional agriculture. And so they need to import foods and then people are eating that more than they're eating traditional foods. So it changed the food ways in a way. You also have the post-war period where you've got a lot of Asians coming into Hawaii and they're bringing that love of spam too. So you've got a kind of war and post-war combination going on there. And so it really thrives in Hawaii. When I was there a couple of years ago, I was amazed to see you could go to like Burger King or McDonald's and there'd be like, you know, spam with rice and eggs. And it was so common. It was amazing. You don't see that in the mainland of the United States, not nearly like that.
And I think it's interesting to look at some of the other links as well, things that you might not consider without delving into it the way you have. But because of ongoing military exercises and preparations, the military had put limits on fishing activities. So again, that kind of changes the diet.
Yes, indeed. So, you know, in a lot of these places, so Guam, Hawaii and elsewhere, in addition to agriculture, they would have a lot of fish because they're islands. But because the U.S. military was using the waters around the islands, they were also putting, you know, sort of bombs in the water so that, mines in the water. And so to protect the islands. And so people often were banned from going out and fishing like they traditionally would have. And so, again, as you said, that changes the diet. And so they had to rely more and more on these imported goods or these American processed goods. And you see that sort of coming through today where you see diets that are very different from what they were before the war because of these changes that went on.
Take us to Korea because, you know, South Korea, in fact. I don't know if they if they have spam in North Korea, do they?
I don't think so. I wasn't allowed to go to North Korea. I would have loved to know that, but I'm pretty sure they do not.
I've got a North Korean friend. I'm going to ask him
I'll
let you know.
I would love to know that. Maybe they have some knock-on version. You know, it's possible.
That's possible, yeah. But take us to South Korea because, you know, it moves into a different phase again, doesn't it? So it's not just, you know, fending off starvation in periods of war. It kind of moves into, you know, really classic cuisine and becomes a very popular part of it.
Yeah, this is really fascinating. I think, you know, this is the first time after my childhood of not wanting to eat spam where I saw it in a totally different light and that spam was thought very differently. So in Korea, it starts kind of in the same way it starts in Europe. So in the Korean War from 1950 to 1953, the American service members arrive again and again they bring spam with them. So you can see it in the American mess halls. And so on. And Americans will carry it with them as gifts during the war to give to the Koreans, but they also use it as leverage. So Koreans at this time are starving. The agriculture is kind of in a shambles because the fighting has gone back and forth up and down the peninsula. And so there's no possibility to have a growing season. There's no organized rationing because the government is very new. It's just come out of a long period of Japanese colonization before and during World War II. And so the Americans are using this sort of Korean hunger because there isn't much there to eat and giving them spam and trading for information about the enemy. And so there's a kind of, it's almost used as a weapon of war in some senses. And so that's really interesting. So it makes a difference between sort of starving and poverty of wartime and having enough to feed yourself. But it has that kind of tinge to it. But it's really interesting because after the war, you know, there's a period for about 34 years when the Koreans can't get spam. So you can buy it in American service areas, you know, the PX on the bases, but Koreans can't get it. However, spam is being sold illegally on the black market. So it's being sort of smuggled off the base and sold. And so spam goes from being the sort of war-torn sort of poverty food or, you know, food for to sustain yourself to a kind of very high value food. So only really wealthy people can buy Spam on the Korean black market, which is amazing. It changes the value completely. In a sense, I think this kind of sets the stage for what happens next. So by 1986, so Korea is having its sort of Winter Olympics. Korea is kind of coming out of its economic depression because of the war. And then the Korean company CJ Cheledong decides that they want a license with the Hormel Corporation to make Spam in Korea. So locally made Spam, which is generally about the same kind of recipe, but slightly less salty, slightly less fatty to fit the Korean diet. And from then on, from it starts to be produced in 1987. From then on, it sort of soars in sales. It becomes hugely popular. So there's about, I think, 500 tons sold the first year and 1,000 tons sold the next year, and just goes on and on and on. So really, really popular, takes off in a way that you wouldn't see it being that popular in the United States.
And it's also become part of a traditional gift-giving enterprise, hasn't it? Especially during national holidays.
Yeah, so this is where I first encountered it, and I was so amazed. So there's two traditional national holidays, which are Chuseok, which is kind of the sort of autumnal festival, which can be August or September usually, and then Solal, which is kind of the New Year celebration. And these are sort of big, huge national festivals. And during this time, people are will go out to different stores and they can buy either like a can of Spam, or often they'll buy gift sets of Spam, which are a couple cans of Spam and then often sort of fancy oils. So these gift sets can range from $20 to $100. They can get quite fancy. And this is given to friends, to family, to work colleagues, and it's kind of an expected and important gift, which is really interesting. So when I was there in the early 2000s, that's when this kind of tradition started with the company, and then it's really taken off. So at this point, it's really popular in Korea, and it about 60% of total Spam sales happen during these two holidays. So it really shows you the really important way it's been taken into Korean food days and become almost part of the national celebration.
What does the company think about Spam being this, you know, kind of exclusive gift in South Korea? I bet they never imagined that their product was going to end up like that.
Well, I wonder, that's possible, but I wonder if it's a clever marketing scheme.
Ah.
So maybe they, you know, like they're business people, you know, and they're in that business. And so they realize that if they marketed this way and they could, you know, get it to sort of be that popular. I think maybe there was already a long tradition of it being popular in Korea and sort of standing for this high value and high quality and like a comfort food. And so they kind of could play into that. It's really interesting when you look at advertisements from sort of when it first started being sold that the company made and then later advertisements, you can see that originally it was sort of sold as kind of, this is an American food. If you buy this food, it sort of is like buying into American lifestyle. But when you get much later, when they start to sell kind of these gift sets, you see it much more as like related to family time and connecting generations. And it's part of, you know, this whole celebration. And so they're marketing it very cleverly to this kind of traditional ideal, which it doesn't fit, but all of a sudden they're helping it to fit. So I think they're very clever in the way in which they place it.
We haven't spoken about Japan yet, but if you think about, you know, the progress and the movement of the American military, it's probably no surprise that it ended up there too and is now incorporated in some of their meals.
Yeah, so it's people in all over Japan eat it, but it's really particularly popular and most eaten in Okinawa. So again, as you said, you know, the course of the war, the Americans took Okinawa first before they were considering going to the home islands. And so that was really important. And so they encountered the Japanese people and then they, you know, fed them again with Spam. Okinawa also was and still is the site of a big American base. And so there's that long history going on. So if you go to Okinawa, you can go to different, I think, fast food chains and you can buy all different Spam things. So it's quite common there. You can also find it in some particularly Okinawan traditional dishes. They'll put Spam in instead of pork or some other kind of protein.
You have all of these recipes in your book, a whole lot.
Yeah.
But tell us about Spam Salog in the Philippines and Spam Musubi in Hawaii.
Okay, so Spam Salog is, it's a kind of It's a traditional Filipino dish, which they've taken instead of pork, they put spam in there instead. So it's essentially like a kind of fried rice and egg and some kind of protein like pork or spam that's sort of cooked up. I think it's often eaten for breakfast. And it's a very simple dish to make, but it's a very traditional dish. And so it's very common because spam is very popular in the Philippines, too. Philippines also have a license with Hormel to make spam there, too. And so it's really, really popular in the Philippines, very common. So, yes, you can find that in the recipes in the back of the book. And also you asked about musubi. That's really great, too. That kind of shows a combination of, I think, Japanese and Hawaiian ingenuity with spam. So it's a bit like if you think of sushi rolled up. So essentially, you've got bits of spam, cooked rice or sticky rice, seaweed, and there's a little bit of like sort of teriyaki sauce or some kind of soy sauce that you put over it, and then you roll it up and you eat it, and it's kind of sort of cylindrical in shape. And it's really delicious too, and that's extremely popular, very tasty. I had it when I was there. Highly recommend it if you ever get the chance to have it.
I'm laughing because you got into this because you hated the taste of it when you were a kid. And now you're telling me that it's really delicious when it's mixed with all these other herbs and spices.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, so your research does a lot to the palate, I would say, especially for a food historian.
So if you were to describe spam's legacy, what would you say?
Wow. I think it depends on where you are in the world. And this has to do with how people encountered it, I think, first, how they encountered it in war, but also how it sort of has continued on in that country. So first, I could say, I think wherever spam was there, you know, if it was there in the war, it's still probably there now in some form. If, for example, you look at the US and the UK, it's not really popular. You can buy it, but it's not really popular. It's kind of thought of as sort of a poor quality. And, you know, it has this sort of negative connotation. It's often thought of as sort of, if you're low income, you buy this sort of thing. It has this negative, idea. But if you go to Asia, as we're talking about in Korea and the Philippines, in Guam, it's hugely popular. It has a long legacy that's been expanded and then incorporated into the dishes there. And so it really just depends on, I guess, your perspective, both in eating and your sort of life experience. And then also, I think, how it's been passed down the generations. So in Asian countries, you know, it's almost like intergenerational sharing, and often food is that way. And so it's sort of become ingrained in those societies because of that.
I had no idea there was so much to the spam story. So thanks for informing us, Kelly.
Oh, certainly. Thank you so much for having me. It was wonderful.
Kelly Spring's book is Spam, A Global History. It's published by Reaction through New South here in Australia.